There's no introductory this, reading this evening, so the wilderness journey, Brother John.
Good evening. Well, that hymn certainly should have woken you up. That was wonderful, wonderful and rousing. So, this morning we had a little bit too much material for the time allowed, so we went through it kind of breakneck pace. So if you stayed with this morning, you'll be doing fine for this evening, because now we can afford to go at a more normal and sensible pace. So feel free to lean a few degrees further back in your chair, poke your feet out just a little bit further, not that far, and we should be good. Here's the book of Job, in summary. This is kind of a neat way, I think, to be able to put the whole book on the screen. The green numbers are the chapter numbers, and it's generally the names of who's speaking. So this is the structure of the book. The very last slide that I will show on Sunday night will also be the entire book on screen, and it'll look so different to this you barely recognize it, but because that will be the spiritual map of the book. This is the structural map of the book. So you've got three chapters of prose at the beginning, and you've got one chapter of prose, chapter 42, at the end, and in between you have this extremely symmetrical structure where you can really see how it's been laid out as a play. I believe the events of Job happened in real life, but the way it's been written up is clearly in a stylized manner. And what you've got is people speaking, and if you just read through the book, it might just seem like chaos. It's not chaos at all. It's very, very carefully structured. The three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, will take it in turns to speak. And after each one of them speaks, Job will reply each time. So Eliphaz speaks, chapters 4, 5, Job replies in 6, 7, Bildad speaks in 8, Job replies 9, 10, and so forth. And there'll be a first round of speeches where each of the friends has a go, a second round of speeches where each of the friends has a go, and there starts off being a third round of speeches, and then at chapter 25, and if you look at that, it's a tiny, tiny chapter, it's clear Job has interrupted and said, enough, I'm done with this. And then Job goes on to give two fairly lengthy speeches, even though they're contiguous. It's clear there's two of them, and my batteries have just died. That's lovely. Oop. Well, nothing else. Whoa, that was clever. Won't do that again. And then Elihu speaks, and then God speaks, and then the matter is ended. Okay, so just a word about the readings. If you follow the daily reading planner, I think the daily reading planner is a wonderful way to read the Bible in a year. Perhaps the only book that really suffers is the book of Job, because you tend to read one chapter per day. And if you read one chapter per day, you're going to get lost, right? You'll sit down after dinner and be like, where do we get to? Who's speaking now? Is this Job or one of the friends? What's going on? At least that happens to me. Does that happen to anyone else? When you go in this, yeah, December can be a tough time for that. I would recommend that you read the book of Job, say one square at a time. Read an attack and a defense, an attack and a defense. So one day read that, second day read that, and you'll get through the debate in about 8 days. That's about the right way to just keep track of what's going on. That's just a suggestion. That's what I like. Okay. Now, oh, look at this. Lots of nerdy graphs. I feel safe now. I feel in my comfort zone. Okay. This is trying to underscore just how deliberate and mathematical and beautiful the book of Job is laid out. What you're looking at there is only the words that Job speaks. And the height of each of these colored bars, be they green, blue, or purple, is how many words he speaks. Doesn't matter if you do it in English or Hebrew, because the proportions are the same. Okay? And so you're looking at the various speeches. The chapter numbers are right here on the bottom. So in chapters 3 and 4, Job gives a speech, and I've called it general. He just gives a general speech to the universe. Then between chapters 6 and 26, that's when you have this big punch-up with the three friends. Okay? And there's different ways you can count the number of words Job speaks. You could say, well, why don't we count up all the words he spoke to Eliphaz, all the words he spoke to Bildad, and all the words he spoke to Zophar. I've done that in blue. Or a different way to do the same thing is to say, why not count all the words Job spoke in the first round of speeches, then in the second, and then in the third? So you've got different options on how you count that, and then you've got his two general speeches at the end. So what, you say? Who cares? What's the value of this? And I actually can see some spiritual value in looking at this very fine structure. First of all, we notice they're kind of scaled to each other. There's almost exactly 100 phrases in that speech, and in that speech, and in almost roughly all of those speeches. So they're actually scaled relative to each other. It's a very deliberate scaling. The account is relayed with great mathematical beauty. But why? Just because it's pretty? Just because it's a fun thing to do? Let's have a look and see if we can see the spiritual lesson that actually can derive from that patterning. So let's just clear away all the extraneous stuff and just leave the number of words Job spoke. There they are. Let's group them all together. I'll put the green ones over there and those there and those there. Look, nice and tidy. Look at that. Okay, what do we notice? What you should notice, and observations, I'll just list them there, is that all the blue ones are about the same. Okay, so what? Okay, but all the blue ones are the same. The purple ones are clearly decreasing, and for those of you who know your mathematics, it's actually a simple exponent. That is to say, this amount is almost exactly half of this one, and this amount is almost exactly half of this one. And the green ones follow a simple exponent as well. This is double that one, and this is double that one. Okay, the observations are obvious. What does that mean? Let me suggest to you some interpretations. First of all, if the amount Job said to any of the three friends is exactly the same, or roughly the same, it suggests that no one friend was any more useful or less useful than any of the others. In that sense, they were all much of a muchness. There was no real distinction between the friends at this first order level. Okay? But the fact that the purples go down and the greens go up is really interesting. And I find that very indicative of the patheticness, the pathos of Job's position. What it says is, when he's in trouble, he's 8 times more likely to talk to a friend than just announce his troubles to the universe. That's probably true for you too. You're probably roughly 8 times more likely to talk to a close friend than just to announce your troubles out loud. But such is the lack of use of his friends that this goes down and down, whereas this goes up and up. And by the end of his troubles, he's actually twice as likely to just announce his troubles to the universe as ever talk to any of his useless 3 friends. And that's the way, I think, that it's just relayed so clearly as to how little use his friends were to him. Do I say that so we can better punch the face in of those 3 friends? By no means. We're here to learn about how we can be useful for our friends. Whatever it is, don't do what they did. What did they do wrong? And I think the guideline is, of course, as we know from the debate, they couldn't stop but saying, we know exactly why this has happened, we know exactly what God is thinking, and we know exactly what you need to do to sort it out. That's the basic tenet of their message, and it makes them the most useless friends to the one who is suffering. There were 7 days when those 3 friends were very comforting to Job, and those were the first 7 days. Do you remember what they said in the first 7 days? Correct. Nothing at all. And unfortunately, sadly, those first 7 days of silence was the smartest things they ever said. And that's partly funny and it's partly sort of poignant, isn't it? And I have to remember that when I'm maybe on the telephone to a friend of mine who's having terrible trouble and going through a pain that I couldn't possibly know about because I've never been in that situation. And I have to tell myself, remember the book of Job. Do not under any circumstances say, I understand, because I know that I don't. Be present. Listen. Sit with. This is what we need to do to be good friends. We need to have a listening ear, not clever ideas for solutions. The 3 friends went horribly wrong. And I think that's communicated very intelligently and very beautifully by that mechanism there. And I think that's why these talks are laid out with so much structure. Okay, I'm going to stop being a nerd now. We go, graphs can go away. We'll go back to real life. Okay. How long did this all last? Well, we know a week goes by in that verse alone where they sat with him in silence for a week. How long did the suffering of Job last? It couldn't be that long because he'd be dead. Clearly, he was highly in a debilitated condition. But it must have been long enough for all these things to happen. And I've drawn this data mainly from chapter 19. His kinsmen, so his family members who lived in his house, he had a big mansion, richest man in the East, left him. Just say, I had enough of this, goodbye. His friends forgot him. How long would it take for your friends to forget you? Depends on the quality of the friend, I suppose, but hopefully weeks or months. How long would it take before maidservants thought you of a stranger? This one's rather interesting. Scorned when I appear in public? If he's that sick, what's he doing going out in public? And the fact of the matter is, if you're very sick, you simply crawl off to your bedroom and lie there in a dark room. But you can't do that for weeks and months. If you're still that sick, even months later, you kind of have to drag yourself up and go out and go to the market and get on with life. His intimate friends detest me, and his physical condition debilitated to the extent that he has nothing but skin and bones. The famous phrase, I have nothing left but the skin of my teeth. You've heard that phrase, comes from the book of Job. So I suggest to you that these events lasted a few months. I would say that would be about typical for this sort of information to become true. Now that, of course, also means there's a strange mitigating factor. We know that Job lived 140 years after this all happened, and we also know he had 10 kids before it happened, which would have taken, in that sort of time, about 60 years. So he probably lived around about 200 years. And we also know that his life was grand beforehand and afterwards. So huge irony here, 99% of Job's life was actually very blessed. And so you might actually say, wow, I wish I could have a life as great as Job's. You'd probably think I was crazy if I said that. But we're actually looking at only a tiny few month long period that Job's life was very blessed. And so when we have that question of, like, if Job was such a good guy and God's a loving God, why did he give him such a horrible life? It was a horrible period that was actually a very small percentage of that life. It's probably worth noticing. When was the book of Job? Can we date it? And is there any spiritual value in dating it? I think there is a little bit of spiritual value. So if you're not a big history fan, I'm not myself, don't worry. We're going towards a nugget of spiritual value, hopefully, and we'll just slog through a teeny bit of history to get there. There's two common suggestions as to when Job goes happens. One is before the flood, and you'll know that if you ever buy a chronological Bible that tries to put all the books in chronological order, and you'll have Job cropping up somewhere in the middle of Genesis, right, before the flood. And the other one is around the time of Abraham. Characteristically, I disagree with both, but I'm going to show you why I disagree with both, and so you can make up your own mind. First of all, Job cannot be before the flood. Mathematically cannot. Here's why. That verse tells you why. That make sense? Job lived 140 years after all that, and he saw the fourth generation of his children. If you go to Genesis 5 and see how long it takes before the flood to see four generations of your children, you have to live over 400 years, right? That's just a simple statistical fact. So if he saw four generations of his children in just 140 years, no way was he before the flood. That's not even mathematically possible. Okay, so all those chronological Bibles, whoosh, out the window, sorry. Afterwards, if you go to Genesis 10, after the flood, the average length you lived to see four generations of your children was 125 years. That's perfect. He lives just a bit longer than that, sees the fourth generation, but not the fifth. That's absolutely right. So we know he's after the flood. Job is after the flood. So that's as close to proof as we can get on that. So the other suggestion comes and says, well, Job is pretty much around the time of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the reason that that suggestion is made is a very sensible one. And it's sensible because it's based on spotting all the names. And you can actually see the names of the friends of Job and the names of, to some extent, Job himself, in that pattern. This is a family tree, right? Here's Abraham. Here's his brother, Nahor, less well-known, who has children, Uz and Buzz. Abraham, yeah, I didn't choose those names. What was he thinking? Abraham has Shua, a son, through Keturah, his wife, and through the more well-known Sarah has Isaac, as well as Ishmael. Isaac gives him Esau, or Edom, and Jacob, or Israel. And through there, we get Teman and Naaman through the tribe of Benjamin. So Eliphaz, what tribe was Eliphaz from? Eliphaz was a Temanite, I hear, just about muttered. And Bildad was a Shuhite, shortest man in the Bible, haha. And Zophar was a Naamathite. And Elihu, curveball, was a... Ha, gotcha. Elihu the... guess wildly off the screen behind you. Yeah, good one. Buzzite. Okay, so there they are. Eliphaz was a Temanite. There's Teman. Zophar, a Naamathite. Bildad, a Shuhite. Elihu, the Buzzite. Where was Job from? We're not told, but someone said the land of... who said that? Oh, well done, Gab. Yes. And the first verse suggests, but does not prove, in the land of Uz, there was a man whose name was Job. So it makes very good sense to say, look, I think we've found the right period in history where they all came from. But it's not going to work, I'll show you later, but it clearly could be downstream from here. At this time, for example, Teman is only a man. By the time Eliphaz is called a Temanite, Teman needs to be a big, mighty tribe. And it says in the Bible it does become a big, mighty tribe. So it's actually much further chronologically downstream. But at least we've got the right name, so I understand why this suggestion is made. But we've already found our first piece of spiritual value. The three friends, we've argued, are the hosts of the Satan. And the three friends are all sons of who? Abraham. Satan is a child of Abraham. The devil is always closer to home than you think. And so there will come a time, many years downstream, when there were people saying, we have Abraham as our father. Who are you, illegitimate person from Nazareth? Right? But they should have known the Old Testament they proclaimed to quote. They should have known that your bloodline doesn't prove anything. I'm a sixth generation Christadelphian. Good for you. So what? Right? Bloodline gives us nothing. Satan too was a child of Abraham. And ironically, Job and Elihu are essentially Gentiles. Right? So we actually have wicked children of Abraham challenging the authenticity of righteous Gentiles. That's a model that we see very strongly in the New Testament. And there's its precedent. Right there back in the Old Testament, in the book of Job. Godliness is in our behavior, the fruits of the Spirit, not in our bloodline. We can't claim it as something we've inherited as any part of our past. So there's some spiritual worth from just checking through the genealogies. And we thought it was a good idea. It's not a foolish idea by any means to say, here's the time then of the book of Job, but it's not, and it can't be. There's a simple reason why not. Job mentions the Red Sea crossing, which kind of puts the nail in the coffin right there, because it then comes all the way downstream to Moses' time. Now, you might say, well, if Job mentions the Red Sea crossing, why doesn't every single expositor in the world, including all the Christadelphian ones, simply notice this? And the answer is, because the mention of the Red Sea crossing is so obscure, you probably won't recognize it for what it is. So it's very hidden. I'm going to try and claim that is a reference to the Red Sea crossing. Pretty bizarre, isn't it? By his power, God churned up the sea. By his wisdom, he cut Rahab to pieces. What does that mean? By his breath, the skies became fair. His hand pierced the gliding serpent. Who on the strength of that alone is prepared to say, that's the Red Sea crossing, that is? Not even one. Well, yes, don't blame you. But it is. How do we know? Let the Bible interpret itself. This word is going to be a good start. This is Rahab. Where have you heard that word before? Jericho. Sadly not. Let me disabuse you of that. No, unfortunately, that's unfortunate English. The English uses exactly the same word for two different Hebrew words. How annoying. The girl's name in Jericho, that faithful woman of old, has a sort of a C in it. It's Rahab. It's a completely different word. However, this word, Rahab, occurs once there and twice in Isaiah. And when we look up the Isaiah references, then I hope we're going to be convinced we're talking about the Red Sea crossing. That unprofitable nation, says God, Egypt, whose help is utterly useless, therefore I call her Rahab the do-nothing. All right? Never mind the context of that statement. That at least tells us Rahab is Egypt. So this monster that was getting pierced is in fact Egypt. And Isaiah is even more helpful by giving us a very graphic description of exactly what Job was saying. Was it not you, God, who cut Rahab, Egypt, to pieces, who pierced that monster through? Was it not you who dried up the sea, there's a giveaway, the waters of the great deep, who made a road in the depths of the sea so that the redeemed might cross over. Now that's a real giveaway, isn't it? It's clear that this passage, drying up the sea, making a road for the redeemed to cross over, that's clearly referencing, and then killing Egypt in the process, that's clearly a reference to the Red Sea crossing. Does that seem reasonable? That much fairer? And all I'm trying to say is, this passage here in Isaiah 51 is the same language as that passage there in Job 26. Have a look at the two and satisfy yourself that that's essentially a paraphrase of the same thing. If you see those two quotes as similar, then you have excellent scriptural evidence to say, yes, Job has referenced the Red Sea crossing. You can't do it without the book of Isaiah. Without those books, quotes from Isaiah, you've got nothing. And I think that's why it's not well known. Nathan. Correct. It actually has the Hebrew word Rahab, but it says something like proud or what does it say?
Yeah, proud.
Proud, which is ironic because we're going to come to the fact that that is the monster, as we already said. So yes, in some translations, you won't be looking at a transliteration of Rahab, but by all means, grab the nearest concordance, look up that word proud. It is the Hebrew word Rahab. So that's what it means. So whether it's translated or transliterated, that is the Hebrew there. And I think that's why it's gone many years undetected. Some of the more modern versions make it a bit obvious. Thanks for that. Okay then, so here is my contention, and I hope this is why it becomes interesting. Job is during the wilderness wandering. And that's going to have spiritual implications as well as just geographical ones. Okay? Israel have just come out through the Red Sea, and Israel are therefore, they have been turned away from the promised land, and they're at an all-time spiritual low. There's us, everyone agrees on that at least, so we can find it down there in the mountains of Edom and the mountains of Seir. And of course, this is exactly where the Israelites have come up from Sinai down in the south on the Exodus and come up to the promised land and not gone into the promised land because of their lack of faith and were turned back for 40 years. And so they come back down again through us. And that's why you have three children of Abraham running into the man in the land of Uz, because that's pretty peculiar anyway, right? Why are there three children of Abraham tramping around, running into a man who lives down here in the mountains of Seir? And this is because this is the story that's going on at the moment. The conquest will come through across the Jordan there. Israel, prior to their Canaan entry, they're wandering. Wandering. That remind you of anything? Where have you come from, Satan? From wandering. Years of wandering to and fro in the earth and up and down in it. Do you now understand where that sentence comes from? It's a sentence of dejection and exhaustion and rejection. It's during the wilderness wandering. That's what that to and fro is talking about. And that's what's caused their bitterness. They were promised a land of milk and honey. And instead they get 40 years. And not only do they get 40 years of desert, sparsely populated desert, there's a man, richest man in all the East. Look at everything that he's got. And he's not one of us. He's a Gentile. That Gentile has got all those riches that we want and that we were promised. And we have to stand here eating dirt, watching him enjoy that. That's where Satan came from, wandering to and fro in the earth. Satan says so himself. It explains why the three children of Abraham meet a Gentile in Uz, because this is the storyline that's going on. So Israel are homeless in the days of Job. Homeless physically and homeless spiritually. What do I mean by homeless spiritually? Let's consider the bigger picture. We'll do a quick whip through 500 years. We'll be drawing from these books, and I'll use this color code. Pink for Genesis, blue for Exodus, yellow for Job, and green for Joshua. Bethel. Jacob is in Bethel, Genesis 35, and he leaves. And long story short, goes down to Egypt. You can see this is beautiful Nile Delta, very green satellite picture. Here's the Nile. There's the Nile Delta there. And then the Exodus happens. We're now in the book of Exodus. And Moses leads the people out across the desert, chased by the Egyptian army, over the Red Sea, to the Gulf of Aqaba, down to Sinai, and then finally up, all the way up towards the Promised Land. And after rejection and wandering around, they finally cross over the Jordan in Joshua 8, and the first place they come to in the scripture is Bethel. So it's a closed loop from Bethel to Bethel. Approximately 500 years have elapsed. So there's us, And so when they're in us, before they've crossed over, they are at the absolute longest time that they've been outside the house of God. And I mean that in a spiritual way as much as I mean it in a physical, geographical way. A long time away from the house of God. There's a message for us. How did Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar get into such a mess? Because they'd been so long outside the house of God. Yes, the ecclesia might be annoying. Yes, the ecclesia might be frustrating. Yes, it might be difficult to go there. You want to quit and go wandering for 500 years in the wilderness? Sure, why not? But you end up like Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, and that's not a happy place to be. That's the suggested lesson that arises just from that map. So there's a lot of spiritual value in seeing just the geography and the history that's allied with the book of Job. Let's meet these three friends then. Let's meet them a little bit, a slide on each maybe. The three friends, the miserable comforters, as Job will call them. Eliphaz the Temanite, he's a child of Abraham of Edom. What do we know about Edom? Here's the characteristic thing we know about Edom. Edom offers no comfort in the wilderness. How ironic, because that's what Eliphaz is going to live up to. And when the Israelites first came out of Egypt and said, please, may we pass through your country. Please let us pass through your country. You may not pass through here, says Edom. If you try, we will march out and attack you with the sword. And that is what Eliphaz is about to do to Job. Job might be a Gentile, but he's very much the child of God, much more than many who are in that wandering multitude. And the context of Teman, Eliphaz the Temanite, the Temans are renowned as wise people. It's almost a university town, if you will. Concerning Edom, this is what the Lord Almighty says. Is there no longer wisdom in Teman? Has counsel perished from the prudent? Has their wisdom decayed? They are renowned for being smart. So Eliphaz has quite a proud family history. He's renowned for being a smart guy. And we'll see that he's very well aware of his reputation in that regard. So here's Eliphaz. He's certainly the leader of the three. Most likely he's the oldest. Why? Because they seem to speak in turn. Elihu will later say, I didn't talk at all because I'm younger than all of you, which suggests that they have spoken in turn in sequence of age. Eliphaz will also make a big deal about how age brings wisdom here. He starts out as the kindest. He actually offers Job comfort in his first speech, but by the time you get to his third speech and he's all angry and proud, he ends up flatly contradicting his first speech. I think we've got that here. Here we go. Here's the first speech. You have instructed many, Job. You have strengthened feeble hands. Remember that. Your words have supported those who stumbled. You have strengthened faltering knees. The same man is about to say this much later. You gave no water to the weary, and you withheld food from the hungry. You sent widows away empty-handed and broke the strength of the fatherless. That's why snares are all around you, why sudden peril terrifies you. Isn't that interesting? He contradicts himself flatly. Why? Because his mood has changed. So he decides to change his story about what he knows about Job completely. Bildad, a child of Abraham through Shua, through Keturah. He has a tendency, quite frankly, to be vicious. Again, sometimes we're not awake to just how vicious some of the words of Scripture are because they're not really unfolding in our lives directly. And it's Bildad that Job's going to interrupt. It's Bildad who starts his third speech and Job says, enough. I don't want to hear any more from you. In fact, no more from any of you. Look at this. This is what happens to the wicked man, says Bildad. Fire resides in his tent. What had happened to Job with respect to fire? Anyone remember? We read it this morning. Yeah, fire came down from the heavens, okay, and consumed the place. Calamity is hungry for him. It eats away part of his skin. What's happened to Job's skin? That, for want of a better description. Worms all over his skin. The wicked man has no children left, no survivor where he once lived. What happens to Job? All 10 children die. So Bildad has rather viciously just said, let me tell you what happens to a wicked man, and just described everything he sees that's happened to Job, including the colour of socks he's wearing, right? He just absolutely says, that's a wicked man right there. When your children sinned against God, God gave them over to the penalty of their sin. That's nice, isn't it? Words of comfort from Bildad. I'm glad your kids are dead. God did the right thing. Wow, that is something else. And Zophar, also a child of Abraham, actually a Jew, the only one who's an Israelite, a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin, most likely the youngest, his assumptions and his arguments are the least well-founded, and he's the one who relies most heavily on the doctrine of retribution. That is the false doctrine that Jesus addresses many years later in John 9. If a bad thing happens to you, you must have done something wrong. It's a very childish doctrine, and it's prevalent throughout the book of Job. Zophar leans on it the most heavily. How I wish that God would speak, that he would open his lips against you and disclose to you the secrets of wisdom. For true wisdom has two sides. Know this, God has even forgotten some of your sin. And he says, here's the doctrine of retribution. If you put away the sin that is in your hand and allow no evil to dwell in your tent, you will lie down with no one to make you afraid, and many will court your favor. Totally false statements there from Zophar. And let's take a moment just to consider also the full extent of Job's suffering. Why am I doing this? Just for dramatic effect? No. What I want to show is that there are different arenas of life. And sometimes when one arena of life is going badly, you can take solace in another. You know, your work is going very badly. It looks like the money is tough to come in. You take comfort in the fact that your family are loving and supportive. Family life is getting different. The kids are a nightmare and the, you know, marital stress. You take comfort in your work or in your hobbies or in something else. But in all the arenas of life, Job, God makes sure that every single one gets knocked down. The physical arena. The night drags on and I toss till dawn. My body is clothed with worms and scabs. My skin is broken and festering. So Job can't enjoy his own body and maybe sort of go out for a run or enjoy some sports. That can't happen. The emotional arena. If only my anguish could be weighed, it would surely outweigh the sand of the seas. Well, at least, well, hang out with your friends then. Take comfort in that. Nope. Their sons mock me in song. I've become a byword among the people. They do not hesitate to spit in my face. I don't know if that's physical or metaphorical. Either way, it's a bad scene. Well, take comfort in your personal life, Job. How can I do that? My breath is offensive to my wife. I am loathsome to my own brothers. Well then, Job, if all else fails, you still have your God. No, I don't, says Job. Not as far as I'm aware. I cry out to you, O God, but you do not answer. I stand up, you merely look at me. You turn on me ruthlessly. With the might of your hand, you attack me. So Job, in all aspects of his physical, emotional, social, personal, and spiritual being, has been reduced to nothing, and he has nowhere to hide from his pain. This is the extent of suffering that Job is put through. And yet, through this, shines forward his character. I know that my Redeemer lives, the most famous words he utters, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another, how my heart yearns within me. Beautiful and inspiring words. He knows, or he trusts, or he believes that despite his circumstances, God will renew him. Now, in what sense does he understand that God will renew him? Does he mean that he will be restored to health and being in this mortal life, or is he referencing resurrection? So, straw poll. How many people think he's talking about the mortal life? And two. And how many people think he's talking about resurrection? Four. There's six people in the room. No, a lot more. And how many people can't raise their arm? There we go. Thought so. So I think the most natural reading of this suggests he's talking about resurrection. That's what I always believe. But curiously, as I explore the other things that Job says, I no longer believe that's the case. I don't think at this point in his life he knew about the hope of resurrection. Again, this can only be solved from the Bible. Let's look at the Bible verses to have a think about that. It doesn't matter that much, but there's a little snippet from that verse again. After my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. Could be talking about restoration in his mortal life, could be talking about resurrection. But when I look at the breadth of the other things Job says, I don't think he can be referencing resurrection. He also says this elsewhere. If only, God, you would hide me in the grave and conceal me till your anger has passed. If only you would set me a time and then remember me. If someone dies, will they live again? All the days of my hard service, I will wait for my renewal to come. Now again, I see that as an ambiguous verse. When he says rhetorically, if someone dies, will they live again? That suggests the answer is no. Yet the other sentences could be understood well in terms of resurrection. To be hid in the grave for a time, and then to be renewed, right? To be remembered after being left in the grave. So this verse, I would suggest to you, could reference resurrection or not. It's ambiguous. You could go either way with that one. But there's at least two others that don't seem to have any wiggle room. At least there is hope for a tree, says Job. If you cut a tree down, it will sprout again. But a man dies and is laid low. He breathes his last and is no more. And I don't believe that anyone who believes in resurrection could bring themselves to say those words. I think everyone in this room, myself included, believes very strongly in the doctrine of resurrection, and we would probably never say this. Look, if you chop a tree down, it might shoot again, but that could never happen for a man. Could you really say that if you believed in resurrection? Or this one. As a cloud vanishes and is gone, so one who goes down to the grave does not return. You don't return from the grave, says Job. He will never come to his house again. I think that one's even more certain. So whereas there's some ambiguity in this and this, these two really have no room for maneuver. There's no way you can believe in resurrection and say one who goes down to the grave cannot return. So I'm left to conclude that actually Job does not actually know about the doctrine of resurrection at this time. I think he will learn it as we walk with him this week, a weekend, and see his knowledge and his understanding and his proximity with his Maker expand. But I think at this point, even though it's against the more popular flow, he does not believe in resurrection, and my evidence is these biblical verses before you. I ask you to explore them in your own time and come to your own decision. Here then is the cry of Job. There's a famous phrase, be careful what you wish for. I want you to remember these words, because tomorrow, someday, we'll be picking up on them. May the day of my birth perish, says Job, and the night it was said, a boy is born. May those who curse days curse my birthday, those who are ready to rouse Leviathan. Job calls for Leviathan to be roused, and believe you me, he's going to get what he called for. Leviathan will be roused. We're going to see that, and we're going to see what that means. But in the meantime, therefore, we're at a point where I think now we can understand the debate that's about to happen, right? We've reached the point where all that argument between him and his three friends is going to start. We might previously have thought those chapters very boring, very tedious, very hard work, and oh my goodness, there's a lot of them. But now we know why there's so many of them. This is Satan versus the righteous man in its most distilled state. And the Satan will be the pride, the human pride of the three friends. And we're going to see how those two meet head to head. And not everything that happens is going to be what we expect, which is going to be the center of the class. But I want to show you, therefore, three facts. I've argued this morning that human pride, as currently housed in the three friends, takes the role of the Satan. We know for a fact that Job takes the role of the righteous man. It says that in the opening verse. We now know from today's class where that fight is going to take place. In the wilderness. What does that remind you of? Nothing, apparently. Interesting. Brave new exciting world coming up. Anyone seen that before? Right. Satan versus the righteous man in the wilderness. And by the end of these talks, I'm going to suggest to you, I'm making a mental note so I don't forget, that I think part of the reason Jesus does what he does when he ends up in the parallel situation many years later is because he knows about this. He's read Job and he's seen what we're about to see tomorrow, and it's going to offer him certain advice as to what he should and should not do when tested by Satan in the wilderness. But here's the run-through. Here's the first time that it happens. Satan versus the righteous man in the wilderness. That will be our class for tomorrow. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, everyone.